Hello, hello, and a big warm welcome to the season finale of AA Opera. Can you believe it?
Not even a little bit.
Episode 103. We've got to count it still, of course, but this is the season finale for season 7, and what an episode we have for you today.
Did I just say 103? Sorry, I meant 104. It goes to show how many episodes we've had, though. I clearly lost count.
But before we get to that, Avi, how are you doing?
I am so excited about today's episode. I can't even explain, but we'll talk about that in a minute. I'm good. Back island side. Back across the pond.
Back across the pond.
And like 3 weeks away from starting rehearsals for Hansel and Gretel, which is also very exciting. I got some work cut out for me for the next couple of months. And then I got a big thing cut out for me. So I'm like looking forward for the next couple of months. But it's all a bit crazy when you think about the next 3.5 months. I'm a bit.
Really?
Huh?
Are we?
Huh?
No, it's gonna
What's
be
happening now? But how are you? How are you doing?
I'm doing well, thanks. Yeah, all going good on this side. The most exciting thing this week, and I think I'm going to share it with you because you will also find this exciting. We have a new houseplant. And
ooh,
yeah, he's called Dennis. He's called Dennis. Named after Dennis Nedry in Jurassic Park. Because it's one of these Kentia palms. Like, you know, like it looks very jungly, and Lewis was like, oh, it's like a plant from Jurassic Park, which he was very satisfied with, which is, to be honest, probably the only way I could get him on board with getting this big house plant for the living room. And I was like, I just jumped on that bandwagon. I was like, oh, let's name him after a character in Jurassic Park. So we've called him Dennis. So that's the highlight of my week.
Do you know what? Plant life, amazing life.
I'm officially a proper plant parent of like a big plant, but it's okay. He needs watered once a week. I think I can manage.
You can manage that. But that's probably going to look so nice. I can't wait to see it.
I know. You need to come over.
I know.
Come over. It's been a while. So
it has been a while.
You can meet them. Yeah.
Also, because what people don't know is that I haven't really been able to travel very much. So I think I haven't been to Ashley's house. We've done most of the recording at my place since January.
You haven't been at my place until you pretty much told me that you were pregnant. It's like,
oh my goodness.
It's been that long. Yeah. So
that's like
we'll sort that out.
Beginning of December, end of June, end of November. No, it was middle of November because I was so sick.
Oh, but we'll fix that.
I have to come over.
Shall we we crack on with the episode, though? I'm so excited for this episode because we had so much fun recording this episode as well. I feel like I can almost sense the energy that we had when we recorded this episode with the delightful Kate Lindsay. It's just so incredible. I can't quite put it into words.
It was the best 30th birthday present I could have asked for because we recorded it 2 days before my birthday. And I was just like, this is the best thing ever. Kate is absolutely amazing. Does not disappoint. She is everything and more. We hope you enjoy this episode. Hello, Kate. This is so exciting that you're here. Can you start off by introducing yourself to our audience?
Yeah. Hi, everybody. My name is Kate Lindsay. I'm a mezzo-soprano. And yeah, I sing opera. I'm not sure what else I need to say.
The coolest job in the world.
Exactly. Exactly. I pinch myself every time.
Kate, we'd love to ask, what was your first experience of opera?
So I grew up, I'm American, but I live in the UK. And I grew up in Virginia, in Richmond, Virginia. And so my first, sort of a combo, I started to take voice lessons when I was about 15 years old. And I'd always wanted to take voice lessons. I enjoyed singing, but I never knew where to go. And there was a girl sitting next to me in choir class in school. And she said, have you ever wanted to take voice lessons? Because I study with this woman and I think your voice, and she only teaches classical music, but I think your voice is right for classical music. And I was like, sure, yeah, I'd love to go meet her. And we were singing a duet in like a Christmas concert. So I went with her to her lesson. And sang, and you know, this is sort of a southern woman, you know, she just said, honey, you're gonna start studying with me, you're gonna come once a week and pay me $20 and we're gonna study. And I didn't know what I was doing, you know, and we started with the Italian songs and arias, and it was completely foreign to me. But at that same time, Virginia Opera was giving free seats to students, like high school students, secondary students. And they were the new nosebleed seats. They would offer them up, and a group of us would take the tickets, just, you know, say, well, sure, okay, let's go see Lucia di Lammermoor. So that was my first experience with opera, was, you know, sitting up in the total nosebleed seats in the Carpenter Center in Richmond, Virginia. And I still wasn't terribly sure about it. It just felt so foreign to me. I did a lot of music theater and all of that, but it felt really foreign to me. But somehow I just sort of, I kept, you know, doing my, you know, music theater-y sort of thing in school, but doing the classical thing with the teacher. And it sort of just happened. I don't really know. You know, it's putting one step in front of the other and saying, okay, well, I guess I'll just keep going with this until it just doesn't happen anymore. I don't know.
Yeah, it worked out very well for you.
Yeah, I like that though.
Yeah, yeah. I sometimes look back and I think it's really good that I did not know the big picture back then, because I'm not sure. I think having a level of naivete like helped me in that regard. And I definitely was tuning in more. You know, my teacher said, oh, you should get opera news and you should get classical singer. And, you know, I'd try to sort of read, but I just didn't identify with it. I just thought that's so far away from me. I couldn't imagine that, but I just thought, well, my teacher gave me the best advice though. She said, it is not about whether you end up singing at La Scala or at the Met or anywhere. She said, what we're doing right here, right now at 15, 16, 17 years of age is that she said, I think you have a talent and we're going to develop your talent. And your duty is to yourself and to developing that talent. And what happens with it doesn't really matter, but your duty is to honor that you have this and we can keep trying to develop it. And that sort of took the pressure off, which was, I think, a very wise thing to say especially at that time in life.
I think all first singing teachers that we go to should have that attitude.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And because it gives you place to play. It gives you place to just explore yourself, whereas I think a lot of us go in saying, okay, we have that perfectionism right at the beginning, and then we don't...
Yeah.
Continue. Yeah.
Having that goal of, I must get the music college, I must do this, I must do that.
Yeah. Yeah. I think also it removes, the hope is as well, you know, from a teaching perspective, as best as one can as a teacher, to remove your ego from the success or failure of the student. You know, that I think that can be a sort of the teacher-student relationship can turn in, you know, some dangerous corners, you know, sometimes, because the student ends up feeling the pressure of the need to succeed through the teacher, or within the teacher-student element, there can be things that sort of happens between parents and children. You know, I want you to have what I didn't have. But maybe for the student, even if they have all the talent in the world and all the gifts in the world, you know what? Maybe you just don't want that life, you know? And it can get really confusing to have to step back and say, Wait a second. I know I have the pipes. Yeah, I get it. But I just don't want it that badly. I don't want that life that badly. And that can bring a lot of tension, you know, between teacher and student. You know, I've seen it. And so those are some of the tricky sort of things to have to navigate. And I even think, you know, if I teach one day, like, I really, really want to be cautious about that. That you know, it's important to have, as a teacher, it's important to have other things in your life yeah. as well that give you a sense of self-worth beyond just the success of your students. Because there's a lot that goes into being a successful singer that is far beyond just having a really good voice. Sorry.
Thank you for that. No, it's good. This is what we like.
You just tell me.
This is why we do this podcast. No, not at all. So when watching you perform, it's clear that you are more than a mezzo. How do you create your performances / characters?
More than a mezzo. What does that mean?
A performer.
You're a performer because a lot of us, you know, we come into the career, we're thinking mostly about the voice. The voice, the voice, the voice, the voice, the voice. And then suddenly we get to the stage part and we don't necessarily have that character building or that dramatic side or that creative own interpretation of a role because so many of the people that we meet along the way tell us what they want and not what we want. So then how do you make the choice? And also, we listen to a lot of recordings. How do you then suck that all out and bring your own thing?
I think there are several things that have sort of influenced that for me. Number one, back in my sort of teenage years when I was doing the music theater thing in school, I had the theater director, her whole philosophy was, I want from all of you 150% every day. And if I don't feel that you're giving it, it sounds cruel, but actually it was really wise. She said, if I don't feel you're giving it, then I'm gonna stop and I'm gonna tell you need to stand up and do it alone, stand up in front of everyone and give and show everyone what you've got. And until you've hit the 150% mark, we're gonna keep having you do this. And the reason she did that was because she said that it is always easier when someone's directing you, it's always easier for them to ask you to take away, to pull away some layers of that, yeah? But it is much harder to have to pull something out of someone who's unwilling or too scared to do it. And so for me, because I'm an introverted person, I would definitely consider myself quite shy. I needed that sort of forcefulness of fear that I did not want to be called out in that way to push myself beyond what I sort of thought I could do. And so that was quite a good lesson because I also realized the best results often happen when you let go and you just do it and you say, I'm not going to worry about what anybody thinks of me here. And that's the beauty of being in the rehearsal space as well. Also, in line with that, when you go into something going sort of full steam ahead with sort of intention, it builds a trust between you and the director and the conductor very quickly so that everyone knows you're all in. You're all in for this. And you're malleable, you're flexible, you want to work, you want to find it. One of the things I've been thinking about a lot lately, because I was just working with some of the open studio artists, the studio artists here in Vienna, one of the young artists said to me the other day, he said, I really want to be a good actor. I really want to be a good actor. And I said, yes, it's really interesting. And I've been thinking about that for the past couple days since. And And there's so much to that, but I think in opera, the opportunity that we're given, which is really different from sort of regular theater and all of that, is that we have this ability to sing, to sort of pull the music through our bodies while at the same time performing the actions. And have the opportunity to be deeply within the text while the music underneath us, most of the time, is offering us our subtext. So we have all these tools at our disposal. But it's all about building that in coordination together so that the body's not doing something completely different from what the voice is doing. Like the voice needs to be supporting the action. Like that's the ultimate goal, I think, for myself. The voice is supporting whatever the action is on stage. They're sort of woven together. And I don't mind imperfection, and I don't mind when I like hearing vulnerability in the sound. And so, that's sort of what I'm thinking about, I think, with my own things. For me, always, 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 I don't get myself so caught. If I get too caught up in how I'm physically doing things, I'm gone. I'm locked. The physical, when I'm thinking staging, I'm locked. When I'm thinking text, I'm in. I'm always in. So what I have to do, even if I've done a role many times, even more so when I've done a role many times, is I have to go to the text every time because I know I'm not authentic. I'm not in an authentic sort of physical space if I'm not really, really living in the text. Is that even an answer to the question, though?
That is. More than, and it makes so much sense because when you do something over and over and over again, you forget the meaning of it. You like forget, it's like when a word becomes redundant because you've said it too many times in a row, or it loses its meaning.
And I think that's the purpose of rehearsal. People don't like to rehearse, but the funny thing is, actually, that's why we rehearse. Because when you take time to incorporate these things into a fluid sort of conversation between your voice and your body and your colleagues and everything else, then that's when it becomes quite interesting. I think when we're in autopilot, we're not. I sort of feel like we're not doing the best we can do for our art form when we move into autopilot. And it's pretty easy to do that sometimes.
Yeah, absolutely. So many of us singers refer to recordings when we learn new repertoire. So we've got two questions to ask around that. What do you think singers should be looking for when they are listening to a recording? And question two is, have you ever thought how many young mezzos are learning from your catalogue of recordings? I ask that because Avi as a mezzo is always listening to your recordings.
All right, well, I'll take the first one first. So what I'm listening for, I'll definitely use recordings as well. And I'm frequently drawn to live recordings because I especially, in terms of opera performances and stuff like that, because I get a better sense of sort of what are the true things that are happening in the moment for singers. But what I'm listening for, or what I'm hoping is possible for within recordings especially, is that you're feeling something from the voice. When I was starting out, I did like an audition recording. And I thought I was doing really well. I thought I was nailing it, my auditions. And what I realized, I listened to that recording and I realized, oh, I was marching all around the room and I was acting all up and down the walls and everything and moving everywhere, but I didn't hear a thing in my voice. It all was just sort of one one color, one sort of one intention, I suppose. And I thought, oh, I have no idea what this character actually feels. And so that was quite a big shift in that I really wanted to start to use the voice. I wanted someone to be able to hear what was going on with the character and the voice. So those are the type, you know, Janet Baker, Lorraine Hunt Lieberson. There was someone else that had a live recording one time. It'll come to me in a bit. But you know, I'm drawn to those voices, you know, when I'm studying. And I like risk taking. I mean, I think it's quite interesting. I like risk taking as well. I know I'm not, when it comes to sort of my recordings, I'm not cognizant of it at all. It's really weird to think about that like young people, you know, young singers are listening to things that I have done. I mean, I don't know why that's sort of weird, because I've been doing this for like 20 years now, but I still feel like I'm starting out. Like in so many ways, I still feel like, you know, So no, I'm not really cognizant of it. And to be honest, like I don't go back and listen to them at all, you know, so I have to sort of, you know, it's difficult to go back and listen. I've gone back to listen to Thousands of Miles, because we do recitals a lot. So it helps me to like quickly review stuff. And, you know, I'll listen to it now and think, and what's hard is I sort of listen to it now and I think, oh, I liked that when it came out. I think I could do that better now. Or I think I know more about life. I could do this differently. Like I've lived more. And that's what's really interesting about recordings, is they come from a set moment, a set point in time, you were in a specific place in your life when you did it, that was informing everything. And, you know, then you come back to it later and you feel sort of so changed and evolved from like those 5 days when you made the recording. It's really something.
Yeah.
Yeah, I just want to say thank you very much for helping me learn a lot of stuff.
Ah, great. I hope it helped.
It does. I'm dyslexic, so I find it very hard to just sit by a piano and learn.
Using
the ear is a lot easier. And I still haven't found the right way to learn, but listening to the recordings, the music goes in much faster.
Sure.
Yeah. It's always funny when you listen to really old recordings and you can see that the diction was not as important back then.
Yes. Yeah.
And then you listen to newer recordings and you're like, wow, they're really precise.
Yeah. And, you know, I don't know how valuable that is necessarily, because there's the precision of it, but then also sometimes it can get slightly in the way of like a really smooth technique as well. Like I'm always sort of trying to play with that balance a little bit too. But yeah, I mean, I use recordings to learn a lot too, or even just to test my memory. You know, if like I'm up and about doing things or whatever, or test my memory on recits, I use recordings to make sure that I have a quick line pickup, you know, that I can anticipate, and it helps me practice listening to what people are saying to me on stage versus only knowing it visually in the score, because we need both of that. So I think it's really, I think it's great to be using, you know, I'd like to use ears and eyes to learn, because if I sort of rely on one too much, then I feel like I could easily have like a mind blank on stage at some point.
Yeah. that's a fear that's yours. Like, needs to go away. Okay.
Yeah.
Anyway.
I'm there.
Many of the roles you sing, as we said, you sing over and over and again. What do you look for each time you revisit them, and how do you not let yourself fall into bad habits?
I'm coming back to a role, I'm really trying to take it from where I am like right now in my life. Like, I don't want to repeat anything that I did 5, 6, 7, 10 years ago, even. I want it to be, even if it's from the same production, I love the idea within this profession that we are always growing and evolving. I mean, what an opportunity, what a privilege it is actually that, like, I feel like I'm always learning, not just sort of intellectually, but, you know, as our bodies are growing and as women, as our bodies change, as our muscles change, we can do different things with roles that we've sung for many years. And even like right now I'm in Vienna and I'm singing Elvira, and I premiered it last season and did one run and then in December, and then came back and did another run in June. And then I'm coming back some months later and I feel her differently. And I feel the sort of vocal approach slightly differently too. And even though I've done the role, I worked with my teacher last week to go back through it again, because I want to incorporate some new ideas into it, new technical ideas vocally. You know, I'm thinking about a different way of supporting it, or a different way of preparing phrases within the action of the character as well. So when I'm coming back to stuff, I'm trying to make it. It's sort of like building a layer upon layer upon layer. You know, I don't want to wash away everything that I've done, but I want to keep building on it so that it feels like I'm. I love feeling sort of that you can play even more within the world and the emotional life of this person through the music. And some of that happens just because when you have sung a role once, there is just no doubt whether you've been practicing it or not, the next time you come to it, it's a different experience, because there's something in your body that already knows it, you know, and your brain can let go of certain things and then you can start to explore other things. I remember that with Componist, I hadn't sung it in a year, but all of a sudden the things I worried about the first time in Glyndebourne, I didn't have to worry about a year later when I was doing it here in Vienna. Mm-hmm. So it's just, I think that's quite, I'm quite fascinated at how our bodies sort of change in that way.
Do you have a favorite role to return to?
Yeah, these days, Strauss, Octavian, Componist. You know, right now I'm really loving Elvira as well. I really enjoy singing Elvira. And I was really scared of her. I was, when they offered it some years ago, I thought, if I don't accept this now, I probably just won't ever do the role. You know, I'll always be a little bit scared of it. And in a way, the pandemic hit at a good time for me, in that when I had nothing to do at home, I picked up the score and I started working on it, you know, a good year and a half before I came to do it. But the Strauss, you know, Octavian, every time I sort of finish a performance of Octavian, I just think, wow, like, what a joy that was. Just like, what a, just a pleasure it was to sing that. And Strauss for sure, and Mozart overall, but as well, I think those are my two sort of anchor points.
Fantastic. We'll talk a bit now about a more recent role that you played. We both saw you in Handmaid's Tale at ENO. And not often do we get as opera singers to be part of general pop culture as well. And to have an opera that's also an award-winning TV series. So what was it like to get the Handmaid's Tale score?
It was utterly overwhelming. That score is big and heavy. And you know how we all do when we get the score and you're like, okay, so, you know, where am I here? Oh, okay, yeah, that scene and then that scene. And then that scene, you go through and you're highlighting, and you're like, okay, scene after scene after scene. It was pretty overwhelming. I mean, I first got the score when they were asking me if I'd be up for doing it. And I listened to the original recording and sort of following along with the score. And the original recording is in Danish, I believe. I'm following along with the score, but reading the text, and I kept getting chills. Like I kept getting chills, and I'd get quite teary. But then the part of me was like, oh no. I don't want to do this. This is going to be a huge mountain to climb. This is going to be a lot of work, but oh God, but if I'm like sitting here crying, sort of already, then oh no, I've got to do it. I struggle with it because I struggle with those sorts of decisions, because doing modern pieces, modern music takes so much more preparation time, so much more time out of your life. And so when I'm thinking about whether to accept it, I'm having to think of all the months ahead of time that I've got to spend working on it. And for me, I knew I had to start, if we were going to start rehearsals in February, I knew I had to be well on my way starting it by August, like latest August. With accepting anything, but especially with sort of difficult long roles, there's the real question of what is this going to cost me? Like, what is it going to cost me in terms of energy? And what is it going to cost me in terms of time? Is spent sort of, I spend a lot of time away from my family anyway, but like just the time that I'm going to have to put into it. And what is it going to cost me in terms of the sort of inherent anxiety about preparing it, because you never sort of feel that you are maybe quite on track. Like, I'm always scared I'm not going to be ready by day one, and I have nightmares about it. When I hit sort of a month or two out, I start to have nightmares that I'm showing up and then like I've learned the wrong opera, or I'm being asked to sing a role that I just don't actually sing, or something like that. Or,
I feel so seen right now.
or like, oh, there's a whole sort of scene that you just didn't know was in there, and so yeah, I mean, it's really normal. And so, but I did say yes. And I am pretty like, I can be quite organized about sort of, okay, I know I need to sort of get going on things, but I always feel quite behind. Thankfully, I have a wonderful friend and coach in Matthew Fletcher, who he works quite a lot in Glyndebourne, and I think is still coaching at Royal Academy of Music. And so he really helped me, because my method for having to learn it, because it's quite complicated music. So my method was like, all right, Matt, can you in your studio record these scenes on the piano, bringing out my part, but giving me the sense of harmony, but with total precision, because I'm like rhythmically always, we have to be super, super precise. That's so important, especially with modern music. But like with very basic precision. And as you record these, send them to me because I'm on the road. And because I don't like to go into a coaching studio and have to bang out notes with the pianist right in the beginning. I'd much rather suffer through that on my own and then go in and start to run the scenes with them. I just think it wastes a lot of time and I don't get much from it. So I'd rather like do a pre-record on those scenes. And then I sat here over the keyboard and had the headphones in, and I just go through the scene again and again and again, easily 10 to 15 times, just, okay, I got through one scene today, and then I go, the next day, all right, now my goal is to do this next scene. again, just banging through it. Then go back and do the scene that I did the day before, add it on. And all of a sudden, the music is just like, what do I say? It's like getting its tentacles into my brain. And I know it's starting to set in when I'm walking around and like the tunes are just in my head. And that's my approach to it, because it helps me feel absolutely, absolutely solid on stage, so that I feel that then anything can happen sort of dramatically. You know, then I feel flexible to do whatever needs to be done, and I'm not freaking out about counting or when I enter. But that's sort of, I guess, beside the point. Sorry, I mean, to do something that people actually, you know, identify with. I did not watch the TV series because I thought I would be constantly, I would be fighting maybe myself or even the direction in rehearsals with pictures in my mind of the show. But I read the book, and the opera was really quite faithful to the book. It was nice to, then I can sort of build pictures in my mind about what it could be. But it was an amazing response also, because, you know, we opened the show. I mean, I remember we had the final dress, and Rachel, one of the assistants on the show, I saw her in the hallway, and we'd just been so in it for weeks, and, you know, COVID went crazy in London, right when London reopened at that point last spring. And I remember just seeing her in the hallway, maybe after one of our final sort of stage rehearsals before we had the final dress. And she just said, she looked at me and she said, "This is a really good opera. We've got a really good production." And I was like, all of a sudden it's sort of like, oh, really? Like, is it good? I mean, I just hadn't even been thinking about, is this good or not? I'm just thinking, like, you know, we've just been so deeply in it, you know, and I have no, especially with that role, I have no perspective as to what it looks, how it looks from the outside, because I never had a chance to like go in the house and see anything. And it just sort of hit me like, oh, like this, it might be good. I don't know. Like it might be good. And then what was quite interesting is, you know, opera houses had struggled and still are struggling to get people back into seats. And what was really surreal is that we only had four performances. And by the third and fourth performances, the house was full. It was, I was really shocked. I sort of realized I haven't felt this since before the pandemic. And even before the pandemic, it could vary quite a lot. And so that was really something to feel that.
And the Coliseum is not a small theater.
That is not a small theater to fill. And I remember the final performance, they were saying, yeah, I mean, people were calling up trying to get tickets, you know, there was a line outside. Yeah. And I thought that people came dressed as handmaids.
I was just about to say.
We saw lots of those. It was a bit weird.
Yeah.
You know, but the thing is, too, it is a story that we truly understand in very present time right now, and certainly in the States, with abortion rights as well, you know, and women's rights generally, and sort of ultra, ultra far right conservatism and all of this. It's, you know, it's a reality that is... that's quite scarily like there and potent. And so I, more than anything, I think it felt really, I don't like to use the word rewarding, but it felt, I felt somehow like fulfilled that I could do something that felt relevant, that I could be part of something that was feeling very currently relevant. And so I'm glad that people wanted to come and see that and be with us in that.
I also remember looking at Ashley because we came to opening night and we turned to each other at the end and we're like, it's so hard to describe the feeling of seeing this because you usually go to the opera and you say, I really enjoyed that. And it wasn't, you couldn't use the word enjoy because it was a phenomenal performance and it moved you so deeply. And I read the book back in 2016, and then when the show came out, I was like, I read the book, I'm okay. I don't need to watch the show. But then seeing it as an opera, and because it was so close to the book, you're reliving those moments, and you're just thinking to yourself, like, oh boy, like, it's so visual, and it's something that we don't usually get in opera. We don't usually get that visceral feeling of understanding what's going on stage to that depth.
Yeah.
And it was really hard to find the words to review our feelings.
Isn't that interesting? Yeah. Yeah. Because you've already been intimate with the story, and then you're really you've been intimately connected to that text, and then to sort of see it play out on stage. Yeah. And the funny thing is too, even from my perspective, I would walk away from it and no, I didn't, I can't say there, I didn't enjoy it. I mean, I enjoyed the team and I enjoyed, how do I put, I mean, there was a fulfillment to it, but it like, you know, I also sort of, it left me pretty like empty too, you know, like it was pretty emotionally, but yeah, it's, but somehow with the story you can, I don't know, it is, I think it was, it's relevant, it's, there's something like that's relevant to it that feels different from to other opera that we experience, because the other opera we're experiencing is sort of taking us to another period in history that's quite distant from us, even when it's opera that's being reinvented or reimagined in a modern day setting, we're still working with the music that was written, you know, hundreds of years ago. So yeah, I mean, it was quite a time. I valued it for the fact that, as well in terms of the text, we were very much all on the same page that, I'd said to Annalise sort of early on, especially when we were going to pre-record the flashback scenes. So I had to go in with several colleagues and we did audio recording and then we did video, filming. And I'd said to her, I don't think there's much point in doing an opera that was written in English, from a book that was written in English, and then go into an opera house and be in a position where we're singing in such a way where people can't understand what we're saying, you know, because that removes the proximity and the intimacy. So, you know, we worked with the sound as well, you know, because we had to pre-record. And so we had really, you know, we had gentle miking on, which nobody was like, was hiding in any way. And I think that really helped. Like, I don't have an ego about that as an opera singer. I'm like, if a microphone helps the audience feel closer to the performers, then let's use it so that people can be engaged with that rather than sort of doing the constant up and down to subtitles.
Yeah.
What did they just say? What's going on? I think that also hopefully made a difference, because also when, as a singer, when you can work with that, you can work with that level of like the extra support of not having to worry about getting like a big sound out, then you can make a lot of clarity with the text. you know, and you can treat
Yeah, there's an intimacy to that.
yeah, and treat it as text and treat it as theater. And I and you know, and the Colosseum is massive, and I think that helped our cause a little bit as well. That this was meant to be a true sort of theatrical production, and that is, yes, still opera, but is offering the use of what we have now to make it as intimate and tangible for the audience as possible.
Yeah, and I think we should look at that going forward because that video and audio element did bring opera into the modern day, and maybe that's why we had so many bums on seats to see it as
Yeah,
well.
because it's not like it's, oh, it's opera with, you know, the nose, you know,
Yeah.
snobby opera and da 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 da, that people aren't thinking about the fact that it's opera. They're thinking about the fact that it's theater, you know, it's sung
Yeah.
theater. And I think that's quite interesting. And, you know, Annalise made the point that I think we also have the tendency in opera to, I think there's a shift happening right now, in fact, that most opera companies have said, well, we've got to just, if we want to get butts in the seats, we need to do the war horses. We got to do Carmen, Bohem, Butterfly, all the things that just sell tickets. But then actually what people are getting more excited about are the sort of interesting new productions, like new music, new sounds, new technology. Funny enough, that's what ends up selling more tickets. And I think that we don't trust the ears of our potential audiences enough to be able to sort of take those sounds in. Because here we are, we're in a generation where we're watching all the Netflixes and, you know, all the streaming. And if you listen to the soundtracks on some of these shows or movies, the music is quite, what's the word? It has its complications to it. It's not just your straight melodic stuff. And I think we need to put a little bit more trust into the public that their ears are astute enough to be able to internalize this musical language as well. And they're hungry to hear something new.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I think also it's the fact that you can cultivate new ears by doing new things
Yes.
because they don't know what the prejudice is of before.
True.
Let them discover the catalog. Don't force them to learn it.
Yeah. I also, interestingly enough, was listening years ago, was listening to a science podcast, and they were talking about the brain and, you know, the brain's interpretation of music. And they were specifically talking about new music and new sounds. And they said it actually takes the brain about three times to start to interpret the new musical language that it's hearing. So you need to give it a few times as well. Like, and now that helps me a bit too, because I know when I sit down and I'm sort of going through something first time, I'm not going to retain it. But the more I keep coming back to it, the language is going to become more clear to me. And now that's so much more real to me now. And they were using the Rite of Spring as an example, because people were utterly, utterly disgusted and shocked with that sound. But at the same time, they came back because they were interested. Wait, let me hear that again. You know, what's all this drama about? Ooh, they were really upset. Oh, you know, and then, you know, it the pe people are like slightly disgusted, but still curious. And then all of a sudden, you know, we listen to that now and we don't think anything of it. But it takes that time to develop our ears. And I do think that that's happening in soundtracks and in other things that we're hearing in everyday life, that maybe we're not, the classical music world doesn't make the connection to that as well as it could, maybe.
Yeah. Now, moving on from playing in Handmaid's Tale, We know asking about motherhood in the industry or as a career woman is quite cliche, but in our industry it's actually quite taboo, and it's very hard to actually make the decision to move on to motherhood when a lot of our teachers and educators, I don't want to say discourage, but haven't chosen that for themselves. So when and having that flourishing traditional career with a traditional family at the same time can seem quite daunting. So firstly, at what point in your career did you have your son? And then following that, did you know anyone that you could ask about having a child alongside a career?
Yeah. Firstly, though, I have to say I'm really curious about this because you guys had asked me, you know, beforehand if we could sort of get into this. And not surprised. I was slightly taken aback that it's seen as taboo. Like a bit taboo. Are people really, are young female singers really verbally being encouraged not to have kids, or is it sort of an unsaid thing?
Off the record, I was told directly that I couldn't have both.
Oh. Wow. So
I've also been like, you have to wait for the right time type thing.
Yeah. So, you know, motherhood in this business, I guess, is tricky. I think I was lucky in that I had someone in my young artist days back in New York. I have someone say to me, you know, a female director in the business, she said to me, you can have your cake and eat it too. Don't let anybody say it differently. You can have your cake and eat it too. And I've thought about that a lot because you can have your cake and eat it too, but you're also going to have a side dish of guilt. And you know, you'll have side dishes of other things. But it is possible. I think everyone's story is different. And knowing that this question was going to come, you know, I have been thinking about it a bit. And you know, I was 37 when I had Finn. And so my career was more established. I don't really know what is the better thing in a lot of ways, because, you know, when you also are older having a child, you know, your energy levels are potentially different. Also, you know, I think when having a child, there's sort of several things to be thinking about, I suppose, or to be considering. What kind of support do you have in your life? Because if you want to sing and also have a family, where can you find support? So are you lucky enough to have family that could help, retired parents? You know, for us, I don't live close to my parents, and you know, we don't have the proximity of family help. Do you have the finances to pay for someone to help you? Three, and maybe these things, you know, also go together. Do you have a partner who is willing to be, you know, truly willing to be quite 50-50 on it? You know, for us, I'm very, very lucky that I have a partner, and yeah, my husband works and all of that stuff. But I also know I go away and he can totally be a single parent. He goes away to work, I can totally be a single parent. And you know, it takes a lot of coordination. But I think the big thing in making a decision and making these big decisions in life, when it comes to family, when it comes to career, what I decided is actually, I was sort of thinking about this a lot and sort of wondering where the heck I was in all of this about 10 years ago, early 30s. And I felt very sort of at sea within the career. And I thought, what does this all mean? And I saw an interview with Friederike von Stade on YouTube. I think she was doing like a recital tour. And they were asking her, here she was, I think sort of in a, it was sort of a bit of a retirement recital tour or something to that effect. And they were asking her, do you have any regrets? You know, do you have any regrets or anything like that? And she said, no, I really don't. But something about that really hit me. And I thought, this is what I need to think about. In 30 years time, 30, 40 years time, when I'm looking back on all of this, this career is finite. You know, it's not going to last forever. The voice doesn't last forever. Our bodies, you know, we move into old age, right? So in 30, 40 years time, when I'm looking back on this, what are the decisions that I will be most proud of making? Or what are the things that I will value more at that point in my life? Because that lends a certain level of perspective on things. So for me, I know that like all the accolades in the world won't carry me to my deathbed, you know?
Yeah.
Like that won't fill me up. I don't really care about any sort of idea of like fame or anything like that. I like the work and I like the people that I work with. Sometimes I don't even care about doing the actual performances. I like the rehearsal. I like the preparation. That I feel good in that space. But that's how I make decisions about work. Well, I think, well, how will I feel when I don't get to do this anymore? What are the things that I will be thinking about and be proud of having done? And that's why I said yes to The Handmaid's Tale. And when it comes to family, that's how I, you know, made the decision with family as well. And it is challenging. And I constantly am dealing with, you know, feelings of guilt that I'm not doing enough, that I'm not enough either to work or to him, or the fact that society judges women much more harshly for being the ones that have to leave and go work. I judge myself quite harshly for that, but I know I'm touchy about feeling like other people might be judging me too. And yet I'm a huge financial support to our family. Yeah.
Yeah.
So it's this constant balance. We're having to negotiate that constantly, but it has made having Finn has made making decisions about work much more clear to me. Like I will not take things that I have to have a very, very clear reason to pick up and take myself away from him and from them. You know, the project has to mean that much to do it. And so that has lended some clarity to it, but it is a challenge. But I have no regrets about that. Yeah. I mean, because it's amazing. Taught me so much. It's taught me so much. It's also taught me that I'm far more capable of managing a hell of a lot more than I ever thought I was. And I feel in a way that I have become a stronger singer and a stronger artist and a more, it doesn't have to be this way for everybody, but I feel that I have a, what's the word? I'm trying to sort of find the word now for it. I have more purpose to what I'm doing because it means more, because I'm so grateful. I love what I do, you know?
Yeah.
And I know the cost of it. I know that my being away costs something. So when I am away, I am full on into it, you know? And the same for, you know, Ollie, my husband, he makes documentary films. So, like, for him, he has to go and do stuff, and it's like, well, then go and do it and don't think about anything else, you know? Do it because you've got to be all in. That's the only way it works, you know? Go wholeheartedly into it. Of course, there are complications. I turned to my friend Erin Morley to ask for advice because she has three kids, and you know, I think she's quite well known, you know, on social media about, you know, talking about and sharing, you know, how she manages. I don't know how she manages with three children. You know, I think they do have an au pair, and or they have, you know, they have someone that helps them. And I think we're getting to the point where we need more consistent help, and it's a, we're const we are constantly sort of renegotiating how to make it work, especially now that Finn has started in reception. He started school this year, so now the game's changed a lot. But there is no clear answer. How do I say this? Everyone's path and everyone's story for how they handle it is totally different. It's just it's and there is never going to be a perfect time to do it. You have to know that when it happens, you will just have to cancel work. You will have to cancel work, you'll have to let it go, and then you'll get back on your feet, and you know, you'll find your way back if you want to find your way back. And one piece of valuable advice Erin gave me was, you know, after having Finn, don't take too much time away from singing. Start to vocalize pretty early on, just to get your muscles back. And that was very good advice. And I got on my feet pretty soon, you know, not soon, but I gave myself a few months. But I started to get back to work. Yeah, you know, and I also think sometimes we can put it off. And this is a funny thing for women, right? Okay, so in our 20s, it's like, I've got all the time in the world. You know, we're just trying so hard to not get pregnant, right? Like, that's what we're having nightmares about, is getting pregnant, okay? And then you hit your early 30s and it's like, no, I got time. I don't, oh, I can't think about it. I can't think about it. And then all of a sudden, you hit like 34, 35. And like you sort of realize, you know, if you, I don't know, if you see your OBGYN or something like that, all of a sudden you're hitting like geriatric zone, like where all of a sudden there's concern about it. Like how in just as few years did I go from the fountain of fertility to, you know, geriatric, you know, whatever, we're very concerned, you know. And so there's a really quick switch that happens sort of 33, 34. And so, you know, if you are putting it off, putting it off, putting off, it is not guaranteed that it's going to be easy for you. So for some people, it's like boom, 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 it just happens. But it is not guaranteed that it's just going to happen, you know? And it's so difficult for women because we carry so much of that, like that burden, you know? And there's sort of no way around it. There's no way around it, and I keep trying to figure out how to negotiate that. But, you know, the husbands aren't carrying the kids, so.
I'm currently pregnant right now, and that is the conversation that we keep having. He's
Congratulations.
like, oh, why do you want this? I'm like, I am growing a human.
Yes. Yeah. Congratulations.
End of conversation.
How far along are you?
Thank you. 14 weeks,
14 weeks.
and I'm doing, yeah, very early,
Mm.
but I'm doing a production of Hansel and Gretel. I'm doing the chorus at Opera Hall and Park. That's 8 months pregnant, so
Great.
that's gonna be fun.
Great. You know what? I mean, I sang until about 10 days before I was due.
Wow.
And I and so in a way, I mean, I don't know. I think I get a little bit stubborn about things too, but I wanted to sort of not to prove that to myself. I just thought I could do it. I thought I can do this. And
Yeah.
I'm glad that you are, and I'm glad that nobody's giving you a hard time about it.
No, actually, Holland Park have been amazing. The thing is, though, that I'm due in end of July, and all of the auditions for everything are September, October. So I'm like, this baby got to come on time.
Due end of July. Yeah. Audition September, October. You can do it.
Yeah.
You can.
So I'm doing recordings April. So that way I won't be so pregnant.
Yeah.
And
yeah. And also that's good because towards the end, just like finding the breathing, you know, just, you know, getting some of that breath and, you know, there's room being taken up with this other little human. But I think too, singing on into the pregnancy is really good. It's really good for the body. Like, it's really good that you're still maintaining that support and you're working with it, because you're learning a lot. You're learning about, wait, okay, the kid's here and kicking me like right under my rib, but I'm gonna find my space right back here today because that's where I can find my breath. you start to really learn your body in a really new sort of different way. And I do, it sort of teaches you that so much of like what we're dealing with as humans and certainly singers, there's so much in our minds that we have to sort of overcome more than anything else. And like with motherhood for me, after having Finn, and I, you know, he was like 5-6 months old and I was doing my first Rosenkavalier and he's still waking up, you know, once or twice a night to feed. And I just thought, okay, I'm on 5-6 hours of sleep and I'm going to sing this. I'm going to sing Octavian tonight and I'm doing it. You know, I don't need to have, you know, I don't need to have had 9 hours of sleep in order to feel like in order to sing this show. I mean, maybe I had some hormones helping me out there, but I don't feel so much that way now. But it's funny, you know, what you can manage to accomplish, you know. And it made me realize how much of my mind is at play in terms of my limitations, how I limit myself. It's my mind that's the issue, not my body. Well, I'm super happy for you, Avi, by the way. Super happy for you. That's exciting.
Thank you.
Kate, thank you so much for this interview today. I think we can all take something from it. Just so people can follow along, where can people find you online?
Yeah, I'm on Instagram at Kate Medzo. That's probably the best place. And also on Facebook, Kate Lindsay Medzo Soprano as well. And then my website is www.katelindsay.com. And yeah, I think those are the easiest places to figure out where I am. If I can figure out where I am.
This has been absolutely incredible. Thank you so, so, so much for joining us.
Pleasure. Thanks for having me.
So, seeing as Kate was part of Handmaid's Tale, the opera, we thought a great question for this week would be, what book that you've read would you like to see as an opera or think would be good as an opera?
Ashley, firstly, you go great first. Question. Love it. Love the question. What comes to mind is To Kill a Mockingbird. It's an absolute classic. And I know the play is actually on the West End or has recently been on the West End right now. And that looked amazing. But I think adding opera to Kill a Mockingbird would be very intense, but also a fantastic production. I think it's quite an emotional book and quite intricate in the character arcs. And I would love to see a score written to that for that.
That's a really good one. Originally, I was thinking of, like, when you said classics, I was like, oh my God, so many classics that I like that haven't been adapted into a musical opera form. But then I was thinking, wouldn't it be really good to have a murder mystery opera?
Yeah.
Like,
like a Murder on the Orient Express.
Like Agatha Christie kind of thing. But I was also trying to think back to like books that I've read in the last couple of months because I've been reading a lot recently. But yeah, I think any murder mystery. And Agatha Christie also has that feeling of like a dramatic stage production.
Yeah, absolutely. Do you know what I think as well? You know how there's a lot of shows coming out on the West End that have an immersive experience element to it?
Mm-hmm.
Like Cabaret, like Guys and Dolls. Wouldn't it be cool if you did like, if there was a murder mystery opera, but it was also quite immersive as well?
That'd be so cool.
We could make so much money, Abby.
Isn't that the dream?
And that is all for episode 103 of...
Sorry, I meant 104.
AA Opera. And that is also all for season 7.
Oh my goodness.
Congrats to us. But thanks for sticking with us, guys. We really hope you enjoyed the entire season. But also a big shout out to Kate for joining us. It was such an honor to speak with you.
Yes, it was so amazing to speak with you. Thank you again for my amazing birthday present. But yeah, it's been an amazing, incredible season. I cannot believe we hit a lot of milestones in this season. One of the biggest ones being hitting episode 100. And now triple digits. We will be back with season 8. Not sure when yet, but stay tuned. Keep posted on our socials. If you've liked this season, please think about buying us a coffee.
Yeah, you can find the link in our bio on Instagram. We're AA Opera everywhere. And please, in the meantime, please subscribe and rate this podcast. It would really help us out. But in the meantime, we'll be back, guys. We'll miss you. But until then, bye-bye.
The sun has gone to bed and so must I. Good.